To order the House Revenue Committee meeting. Welcome everybody here this morning, and we have four bills before us today brought to us by the State Treasurer. Dick, anything preliminary, or should we just head into the...
Proceed.
...into the agenda. All right, let's do that then. Begin with the public hearing on House Bill 2133. I don't have a sign-up sheet.
Coming.
It's coming. I'll bet these are all going to look pretty much the same. Thank you very much. Okay. Darren Bond, you're with us on 2133. No, you're not.
No.
That's easy. Hi.
Hi. Thank you.
Please go ahead.
For the record, I'm Edie Kessel. I'm the cash management analyst with the Oregon State Treasury. House Bill 2133 is basically a housekeeping measure that proposes revisions to three separate statutes. The changes are intended to clarify existing statute, make a technical change to an administrative task responsibility, and add specific language resulting in more cost-effective management of fiscal agent contracts. The first change in Section 1 of the bill is technical in nature. The statute, as currently written, could be interpreted to mean that the State Treasury is responsible for the transfer of residual monies in agency accounts that are held at the Treasury. These transactions are routinely carried out by the agencies and should not be assigned to Treasury. Therefore, this has no impact on current practices. The department currently carries out these transfers. The second change appears in Section 2. ORS 288-020 currently allows the Oregon State Treasury to designate a fiscal agent for the payment of bonds that are issued by the State of Oregon or any subdivision. Current language prohibits the Treasury from extending a fiscal agent contract for more than 1 2-year period. This requires that the Treasury enter into a new contract with a fiscal agent after only one extension. This becomes quite costly in that attorneys are usually retained for both sides to renegotiate that contract. The change we are requesting in Section 2 will allow the Treasury to continue to review the fiscal agent relationship throughout the contract's 2-year life, but doesn't restrict the number of times that the Treasury can extend that contract. Due to the cost and scope of establishing a fiscal agent relationship, both the bank and the state expect and need a long-term relationship to justify the transaction. Section 3 addresses the interest amounts that are charged on borrowed funds and provides for consistency across interfund borrowing statutes. The current language in ORS 293-214, subsection 4, provides for funds to be paid back with the interest that would have been earned had the dollars remained in the fund from which they were borrowed. However, this statute is not used because it does not adequately address the credit and market risk associated with borrowing. Additionally, the language is inconsistent with ORS 293-220, which provides that the interest rate on borrowed funds will be negotiated between the State Treasurer and the officer, State Department, Commission, or Board in charge of the borrowing fund. For these two reasons, we are seeking to have the entire paragraph, subsection 4, repealed. Section 4 of the bill amends ORS 293-220 by adding reference to ORS 293-214, resulting in the same interest reimbursement policy as applies to loans made under ORS 293-220.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? On Section 3, I guess, if you could just kind of enlighten the committee a little bit on interfund borrowing. Give us a little bit of background on what goes on in interfund borrowing, and then I guess the impact of repealing that particular section on the interest rate.
Mr. Chair, interfund borrowing is basically an opportunity that agencies would have if they are having some cash flow issues. They would come to the Treasury to request basically a loan, and that is done from the Oregon Short-Term Fund. These are cash flow issues that have been previously approved by the legislature. They are, you know, they're not going over and above anything that their budget would allow. And what they would do is submit different documentation, and the Treasury would look at that and analyze it, make sure that the loan makes sense, make sure that there is cash flow that is coming in. and that there is cash that will be available to repay that loan. We're very conservative when we look at those loans.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Williams.
Perhaps it would help if you could give us maybe just a simple example of an agency situation where this comes up on a frequent basis.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Williams. Currently, we have one loan that's outstanding, and that's with the Department of Forestry. And what has happened is through the last few fire seasons, there's been a lot of money that they've put out, and they have to go through a pretty extensive reimbursement policy or process with the federal government and others. And at this point, they're still waiting for those reimbursements to come through. There is cash flow that is out there, and they will have those monies. But now they're a little short on meeting some obligations, so we have a contract with them, a loan actually with them, that is helping them to be able to repay those current obligations before they get the reimbursements from the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
And the questions on that, then the loan in this case was made from the short term?
Oregon Short Term Fund.
Okay, and currently under statute, I guess what in subsection 4 of the statute that we're repealing in the bill, what do you have to calculate what the blended rate of return is in the Oregon Short Term Fund, and that is the rate that the agency is supposed to repay the fund?
Mr. Chair, currently the section that we're repealing is not, we don't use that statute when we're doing those loans, those interfund loans, but what is done, what we'd like to have the net result be is that we would look at maturities, we look at when the loan is, they'd like to have the loan paid off, we look at treasuries that have the same type of maturity date and look at what that rate is, and then would usually go maybe 50 basis points or more above that just to get, you know, make sure that we're able to get back what risk we've incurred by lending that money to them.
I guess if we repeal the language in the statute, and I'm just trying to make a record here, I think, as much as anything, if we repeal the language in the statute, is it then is it somewhere else in statute, or is it practice that provides that the Treasury will in fact charge interest or some return on the money borrowed from the short-term fund? Where else does that occur then? If you don't rely on this statute now, where will that happen?
Mr. Chair, Section 4 of this bill addresses ORS 293-220. And we're amending that to actually include 293-214 as an entire statute. And we'd take out that section four, but we will add that reference to 293-220. So
that's the bolded language in section four.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's to make them consistent between the two statutes.
Very good. Thank you. That settles that. Other questions? All right. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2133? All right, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2133 and open a work session. Jake, did you have anything else to say on this?
Mr. Chair, Legislative Fiscal has expressed an interest in having an amendment to this which would require the Treasurer essentially to notify the Fiscal Office when they do make these fund transfers, but we've not had anything drafted, and I don't know whether you want to consider that.
Did you know anything about that? Yeah, Darren.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance. Actually, I called LFO because they have a similar requirement, ORS 293-210, which is the interfund borrowing statute we actively use because of the interest discrepancy here, and notified them that they might look at that since we had the section open. But I hadn't heard anything back from them, so I'm not surprised, but I hadn't heard anything.
Well,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is that something that needs to be in law? I mean, it would seem like for practical purposes that would occur.
For practical purposes, I'm going to notify them anyway since I do under 293-210. And for practical purposes, 293-210 is where about 95% of our activity is going to continue to be anyway.
Well, I guess I'll leave it to the committee's pleasure. My inclination would be to go ahead and move this thing along. I mean, this is, sounds like they've been contacted a couple of times. If it's an amendment that's essential, they could always put it in the Senate. That's not going to be a problem with this bill, but I'm not inclined just to stop it for the sake of waiting for a few more days on something that is otherwise ready to go. Representative William, I'm sorry, you were going to You were ahead. Or were you just going to move the bill?
I was going to move the bill, Mr. Chairman, but I'll defer.
Now you're not going to, are you?
Well, I still will, Mr. Chair, but I'll defer until all the committees had a chance.
Representative Berger.
I just have a question.
Yeah.
Be sure that I understand. In other words, the fiscal office won't put somewhere in the bill that they would be notified. Is that what I'm hearing?
But they've not offered any amendments.
That's correct.
But they've not offered any amendments.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, with that, then, I think my inclination would be if the committee is willing, we'll go ahead and move this thing forward, and if it's something that LFO really needs to get in, they'll have another shot in a receptive revenue committee down on the other end of the building. So, Representative Williams?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2133 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2133 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Aye.
Barr.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. House Bill 2133 goes to the floor with a due pass. We need a carrier. Representative Williams, you got it. We'll have a few carriers today, I expect. All right, let's go to a public hearing on House Bill 2134, and Darren will call you back up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Darren Vaughn, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. House Bill 2134 is a housekeeping bill clarifying existing language in ORS 291001, dealing with checks, warrants, and electronic funds transfers. Current language says that the words are interchangeable. The Department of Justice has informed us that this could be construed to mean that they're the same thing. This was not the intent. The goal of this language was to provide the flexibility to use appropriate payment methodologies without rewriting every reference to warrant or check in statute. New language provides for this flexibility without blurring the important distinction between these payment types. No new functionality or flexibilities provided by the language. Section 2 of the bill simply cleans up a reference to this language in some PERS statutes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Okay. Seems pretty straightforward. Dick, do you have anything?
No comment.
All right. Okay. Any other witnesses to testify on House Bill 2134? All right. We'll close public hearing on House Bill 2134 and open a work session. Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2134 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Scott moves House Bill 2134 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, please call the roll when you get sat down.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2134 goes to the floor with a due pass. Representative Berger, do you want this one? You were volunteering
sure.
For the last one.
Okay.
All right. We'll go on. It's two down. House Bill 2135. We'll open a public hearing on that. And Darren Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. For a bit of background, as the state's cash manager, Treasury's been deeply involved in addressing the general fund cash flow issues resulting from the budget problems this biennium. This resulted in the short-term borrowing legislation passed during the first special session, which allowed for the issuance of tax anticipation notes to address the negative and declining cash balances the state faced in the middle of the biennium. As we looked at possible options for a state response to the deteriorating cash flows, we identified a number of weaknesses in the current statutes and asked for review by the Department of Justice. This bill is a result of that review. The work centered on four elements: defining the general fund, determining if the statutes dealing with the general fund cash flow issues are adequate, clarifying when the treasurer can pay money, and determining if the treasurer can direct an agency to stop issuing payment obligations. An area of special concern included those statutes that deal with specific state responses to a general fund that becomes exhausted.
That's a topical.
Yes, isn't it? That's why it's here. What was the toughest question DOJ had to grapple with? and that's what is the composition of the general for these purposes. The question highlights the muddled state of the statutes relative to establishing state agency accounts. A number of sections of the bill address this issue. As is often the case, the simplest approach proved to be the most effective. By simply stating that the general fund consists of funds and accounts that are specifically designated as in the general fund, the muddle's cleared up. Additionally, this is consistent with current DAS and Treasury practice recognizing accounts in the general fund and has no impact on general fund balances as currently reported. These changes are found in sections 1 through 4 of the bill. Another inconsistency in defining the general fund involved trust funds. By their very definition, trust funds are set aside for a specific purpose and are not available for general government expenditure and therefore should not be in the general fund. However, there are a few instances in the statutes where trust funds were in fact created in the general fund. We found that the statutes are not sufficiently clear in directing the trust funds are separate and distinct from the general fund. In response, we've strengthened the current implication in ORS 293110 that trust funds are not to be placed in the general fund by explicitly stating that they're separate and distinct from the general fund in 293115 sub 1, as amended by the bill in sections 3 and 4. We've also removed these two trust funds from the general fund and made them separate and distinct. Legislative Council used Section 5 of the bill to insert a clarification that monies in trust funds are continuously appropriated to carry out the purposes of the trust unless those funds are addressed in other appropriation law. Section 6 aligns ORS 293165 with the changes made in Section 7 and with the removal of the trust funds from the general fund in Sections 3 and 4. An area that undergoes significant revision by the bill is ORS 293170, dealing with the registration of warrants. This is in Section 7. For a little background in this area, it's important to keep in mind that the state makes payments using one of three predominant payment methods, checks, warrants, and electronic funds transfers. In terms of volume, we issue the most checks, then EFTs, and then warrants. Checks and EFTs tend to be used for program payments, while warrants are predominantly used to pay the state's bills. Another significant difference in these three payment methods is in the rights gained by receiving one of these payment items. With an EFT, the money is transferred directly to the recipient.
Mr. Darren, if you could just stop for a second.
Sorry.
Have we ever actually issued warrants?
We issue warrants every day.
Okay.
With an EFT, the money is transferred directly to the recipient's account who has immediate access to the funds. Receipt of a check provides the recipient the ability to make a demand upon the state for the amount owed as represented by the check. A warrant, while normally treated like a demand item, is actually evidence of an obligation owed and a request for payment. This is an important distinction because under certain circumstances, that request for payment can and must be postponed. These circumstances are described in ORS 293170. The statute describes the process put in place should the state run out of money and be unable to pay general fund warrants.
If you could just for a second, again, since this is dealing with an area that we don't often get into in this committee, but to whom would a warrant be issued and under what circumstances?
Vendors. They use them for reimbursements of employees for travel expenses. They tend to be bills, agency bills, utility bills, things like that. Whereas benefit payments, payroll payments, things like that tend to be made via check or ACH, electronic funds transfers.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Mr. Bond, could you give us I know you said that, was it checks, then electronic funds transfers, then warrants,
sure,
in sort of that order
volumes.
Of volumes? But give me maybe a dollar sense, if you can, of the volume of warrants that we issue versus checks and electronic funds transfer. Are we talking, 10% of everything we do, or is it 30% of everything we do, or do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I really don't have an idea on the dollar volumes. I can tell you the numbers that we do. Dollar-wise, I don't know. They're all the same to me when I pay them.
A million.
So on a daily basis.
The distinction could become different. It could become important.
Well, I think it's the dollar volume issue that I think is interesting, only because to the extent that it is a
on a per item basis, warrants are bigger.
An evidence of obligation,
right,
and a demand and a
request.
A request for, right, payment. I think to the extent that we're doing 40% of our business like that versus 8% of our business like that, I think that's from a management standpoint at our level. I think that's something that would be helpful to know.
Well, and I guess I would be curious, again, just in terms of how these... have we seen an increase in the use of warrants in this current cash flow and budget period that we've been in the last year and a half, or have you been maintaining business as usual, interfund transfers and all
that?
We
haven't really seen a large increase in volume. We tend to see an increase in check volume and ACH volume during these periods because there's more transfer payments, and those are done via check.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be careful to start checking my own check now to see if it says warrant at the top of it, because I think that sends a pretty important signal.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, my context of warrants is when California issued warrants to its employees a few years ago when they ran out of money. And are we talking about two different kinds of warrants here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, that's exactly the same kind of an instrument.
I thought those were kind of like IOUs, and maybe that's what they are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, there's the ability for the state to turn them into IOUs, and that's what this is about, actually, is rewriting that part of the statutes. The state has the ability, should the general fund run out of money, to not pay warrants and to convert those items into an interest-bearing instrument, and that the holder then has the right to claim interest of 5% on from the state.
Is that what we're doing here with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, no. What we're doing is that language is already in statute. Okay. We're modernizing and clarifying that language to make it workable.
Okay.
You know, given the state of the general fund and given the dislocation between general fund receipts and expenditures, there is an outside possibility that we could be in a situation like that, given the kind of budget issues that we've been faced. We expect we'll be able to manage through that, and I expect in my career I'll never have to be involved in a registration of warrants process, but the fact of the matter is the statute requires us to do it under certain circumstances, and as we reviewed these statutes during the interim, we found out that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to implement the way they're currently crafted. So we're simply trying to update those existing statutes so that we could put a workable process in place to support the state in this situation.
Well, and all good work, I suppose. It's just a sign of the times that we are concerned about making this workable and out of concern that we may. This reminds me of the special session where we took up the bill dealing with what would happen if courts had to close one day a week, in terms of how that would affect statute of limitation and filing deadlines and things like that. And lo and behold, here we are. One question I have on the warrants, how does that relate to state debt limitation? I mean, if you've got $50,000 under the Constitution or the state debt limitation, can you have warrants of more than that amount extending beyond the end of a biennium, or do they have to be cleaned up within a biennium?
Mr. Chair, I believe that they would need to be cleaned up during the biennium, and that would be that would happen if the constitutional mandate to balance the budget is met.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, there's no circumstance where we're talking about carrying over.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could clarify,
yeah.
They'd have to be paid for by monies accruing to that biennium. You could actually have a situation where warrants were paid later because
okay.
monies accruing
sure.
to this biennium
sure.
didn't come in until July or something.
Yeah. Okay. See, I told you we don't get to talk about this very much, but it's all very interesting. Representative Barner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when I'm talking about something that's new to me, my brain gets very concrete. Let me ask you a couple questions so that I can understand it. I take it that most of the time a warrant is treated like a check. It's offered for service, for payment, and it's paid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
We've
never not treated them that way.
Okay, and if I may.
Mm-hmm.
And if... So in a situation in which we run out of money, we can then, when it's presented for payment, we can say, sorry, we're not going to pay you now, but we will pay you 5% interest.
Mr. Chair.
When we do pay you.
Representative Barnhart, that is correct.
I got it. Thank you.
And again, just to clarify, and you go on there, Darren, but nothing in this changes that aspect of warrants. This is primarily, you described housekeeping, this is clarification, this is making this workable. Is that what
Mr.
we're getting
Chair,
at?
Correct.
Okay, well, go ahead.
As we looked at the statutes during our review of all these scenarios, we determined that the current language needed to be clarified and modernized. The current language recognizes that there are restrictive accounts in the general fund that can only be used for certain limited purposes, but it does not provide for the continued payment of warrants drawn against those restricted funds should we be in a registration of warrants environment.
And again, terminology, registration of warrants, that is what we're talking about when you convert a warrant to a note, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
The current language would prohibit the treasurer from honoring warrants drawn against the lottery fund because the Constitution places the lottery fund in the general fund, even though the lottery fund would have money in it. Federally funded programs could be similarly impacted. We rectify this by creating new language that defines a restricted fund as a fund that is constitutionally or federally restricted, and then carving out restricted funds from the registration requirements later in the section. The new language also modernizes the registration process outlined in the statutes to bring it in conformance with modern banking practice.
Darren, hang on a second. Again, we're all trying to catch up here. So this is a situation where you've got a warrant drawn on, let's say, the lottery?
Yeah.
Okay. The treasurer, for whatever reason, has gone into registration of warrants drawn on general fund. And you're saying that by segregating out lottery from general fund, you'd be able to honor warrants drawn on the lottery because there's funds in the lottery, and those warrants wouldn't necessarily be tied up with the registration of warrants under the general fund?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
The current process describes an exhausted general fund as mm-hmm. when the general fund, except for these constitutionally and federally restricted funds, is out of money.
Right.
So those monies aren't in the game. So it sets those aside. What it doesn't currently do is it doesn't address those separately for payment when we're registering warrants. It says we'll register all general fund warrants, yes. which appears to be an oversight when the statutes were originally
okay.
written. The new language also modernizes the registration process outlined in the statutes to bring it in conformance with modern banking practice. The current language was developed at a time when it was envisioned that all warrants would be presented directly at Treasury by the payee and individually recorded. This is not what would happen today. The vast majority of warrants will be presented through the banking system, and the registration process will be automated. Since we have no way of knowing the order that they were presented at the banks, we'll register the warrants by number and date of presentment, other than have the warrants registered according to the order in which they were presented, which is how the current language reads. The warrants will in turn become payable according to the date of registration, as opposed to in order they're registered.
Again, all good stuff. This is breathtaking, though. I mean, this is it's all very dry and bloodless here, but it's like sitting in the Rand Corporation designing the mutually assured destruction theory. I mean, it is. We're talking serious stuff here. Doomsday. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last sentence that you said, you used a different form of words to describe two things, but they sounded like the same thing to me. Could you say them again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, since I'm not exactly sure what I said.
The last two sentences of your
prepared testimony. Currently,
you were talking about when the warrants would be paid. And the two phrases you used sounded like they were meant the same thing to me.
Darren, I think you've got in quoted language here in your testimony. One is according to the order in which they've been presented, and the other is according to the date of registration. You were distinguishing those two.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, now the way the statutes are built is we would bring these warrants in and record them by number in the order that they're presented when people are standing in a line at the desk of Treasury and we're writing them down. And then when we repay those warrants, we go right back down that line and pay as whatever we have money for today plus interest. In today's world, that's not practical. Instead, what happens is we'll get a file of these instruments in from the bank and we'll determine that we can't pay warrants today. We're in this registration of warrant process, and we'll record all of those warrants and we'll give them a date stamp. But we don't know when they were presented at the banks. We have no way of knowing the order. I just know the day. And so when it comes time to repay warrants, I'll pay them by day so everybody is treated equally, but I can't pay them in the order because there's no longer that one, two. The order refers to warrant number. And instead of looking at warrant number, we're going to be looking at date of redemption, date of presentment.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I think this is probably from a time when we still had the hitching post out in front of the state capitol.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I think that's exactly yeah. right.
Yeah. Well, you know, but again, getting to behind the bloodless element of this, what we're talking about is warrants presented to banks that have been conditionally honored by banks. And can you imagine the havoc out in people's bank accounts when those make their way through the system and are then appropriately dishonored or registered, I should say, registered, and then those checks drawn on those warrants out there in the system? Cool.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm very glad we have this bill, because if that situation should ever arise, we certainly want to make sure that we're handling that situation in the most efficient way we can. And that's what your proposal, as I understand it, really is about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, that's our goal.
Okay.
The other substantive change in this section eliminates the need for all three of the constitutional officers, the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state, to agree that warrants need to be registered, and replaces that with an agreement of any two of the officers. We feel this is more prudent given the potentially highly charged atmosphere expected around an issue like this. Again, it's important to note that the decision here is not about whether or not to return the warrants unpaid. The decision is whether to do so in an orderly manner that provides for interest on the instruments and provides the holders with the liquidity through the development of a secondary market to sell them in, which we would expect to see. The decision to return the warrants will have already been made based on the existing deficit balances in the fund and the lack of sufficient monies to make further payments, as described in Section 8.1, which replaces similar language found in ORS 293405.
Why would you reduce the number? What's cumbersome about the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, as we talked about the possible scenarios, what we feared could happen was a situation where the state's out of money and the treasurer has decided that he can no longer pay warrants, that there's no funds available. But we have one of the constitutional officers that, for some reason, is not as aware of the issue, hasn't been involved in the process. It would be the governor and the treasurer who would be very much on a day-to-day basis involved in the issue, and the secretary of state not. And so maybe the secretary of state doesn't agree to the need, needs more time to digest the issues. Whatever the case may be, but the treasurer's going to return the warrants.
So your concern is that one of them is sitting at the lunch desk and can't bring himself to push the button.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It doesn't make or break the bill, clearly. We just thought, as we looked at it, if you don't have all three of them agreeing in unison, nodding their heads, then the warrants are going to go back unpaid, with no interest, not registered, and that will create, you know, that will make a crisis into an out-and-out tragedy out there. And so we just thought this was...
credit rating right at the...
Well, I imagine credit rating. I imagine once you go to registration, you've tanked your credit rating.
Well, it could be worse.
Yes.
We could be below California and Louisiana?
Yes, if we return warrants without this element, I would think we would, while we will suffer a credit downgrade, our credibility would be absolutely shot in the markets.
Okay. So they don't all three have to have a piece of the code that Representative
Well, another way of thinking about this proposal is that the treasurer is going to decide that he's out of money, and the check on him is that either the governor or the secretary of state has to agree with him that he should go to the system. That's what your proposal is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, should go to the system of registering warrants and paying interest.
Correct.
Keeping in mind that it's the treasurer's responsibility under statute to determine if there's sufficient monies to pay and if there's not, to return the warrants. We'd be happy to share that responsibility, too.
But if I may, Mr. Chair, this section we're talking about puts an added check on the treasurer because it requires the governor or the secretary of state to agree that they need to go to this registering warrants and the other things we've said.
But right now it takes all three. So this is actually
right now it takes all three.
And this just this is reducing that to easier.
But we're but we are maintaining a check. The secretary of state, or the, excuse me, the treasurer can't do it by himself.
Right.
Mr. Chair of Zamora, that's correct.
Okay. Go ahead. Oh, Dick, did you have something?
I was just going to ask, am I right in understanding that the alternative to registering is just to return them?
Yeah.
Unpaid.
Unpaid.
Dishonored.
Yes.
In SF.
Okay.
ORS 293405 basically says the treasurer will only pay out of the treasury legally authorized payments for which there are sufficient funds to pay. This is a policy with good intent, but it gives the treasurer the responsibility of determining the appropriateness of about 13 million payment items a year, payments for which the treasurer has little or no information. House Bill 2135 retains this requirement, but adds language stating that whenever a state officer signs or otherwise authorizes a payment item, the officer is certifying that the expenditures are authorized by law. This language describes what authorized by law means and provides that the treasurer can rely on such certification. Legislative Council made these modifications by inserting new language in Section 8 of the bill and repealing ORS 293405.
I'm just curious, Darren, do you know, is there an aspect of personal liability at this point under current law for making payments or authorizing authorizing payments that are not?
Mr. Chair, I believe that an officer always has personal liability for acting not in the interest of the state. That's a better question for DOJ. I happen to have DOJ here if we want to pursue that. So
here, basically, though, we're shifting rather than a certification that there are sufficient funds to pay, the authorization, or at least the we're converting that to a certification that the expenditure is authorized by law, not that there are sufficient funds to pay it.
Mr. Chair, currently, the treasurer is responsible for both of those,
mm-hmm.
both ensuring that an item is authorized by law and that there are sufficient funds to pay.
Mm-hmm.
What we'd like to do is share the burden of authorized by law because we have no information on the background of these payment items, these 13 million payment items that come a year. We're a bank. They come in the door. We pay them. And so what this will do is this provides us actually some cover in that we have certification from the officers out in agency land writing these checks that they're doing so according to law.
Okay.
Mr. Sheriff.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that the officers who soon will be responsible have some knowledge that this is happening.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, the Department of Administrative Services does. We've shared that with them. I haven't discussed it with any other state officers. They shouldn't be authorizing any kind of business that's not authorized by law. We just haven't made the connection. The payments associated with that, we haven't attached that same level of responsibility out to the agencies. We've left that at the treasurer, where there's no information for the treasurer to be able to really to make such judgments.
So this gives you the ability to rely on a certification of the state officer, whoever it is, that the payment is authorized.
Yes, and it elevates the responsibility of those state officers out there to make sure that the payments are authorized.
Just for Mr. Chair, point of clarification, excuse me, for myself. How many people are we talking about? How many people are currently authorized to sign off on a bill? How deep into the ranks does it go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, there are hundreds of people that are authorized to sign a check going on the state treasury. I think there's around 300 checking accounts in state agencies. Some of them, there are some ODOT accounts that literally have several dozen signers because of field offices spread around the state. So, okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Burke.
And that is controlled through your office or through DAS? Who has that authority?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the the accounts are at Treasury, mm-hmm. and the signature authorization forms are at Treasury. It's actually the agency's responsibility through their internal control structure to determine what's the appropriate mix of signers that they have at the agencies, given the kind of business that they do and what their business needs are.
Isn't that basically sort of like the bank? You've got the signature cards, but it's up to the agency to determine who's on the cards.
Okay. Another anomaly we detected in the statutes is that there's currently no provision for revoking an agency's ability to issue a payment item. Section 9 of the bill provides the treasurer authority to revoke this ability under certain circumstances, such as the agency's out of money, does not have a budget, or is writing checks out of an account that is reimbursed by the general fund when the general fund is exhausted. Finally, in Section 10 of the bill, we've addressed overdrafts of agency accounts. Occasionally, agencies overdraft accounts at Treasury. Generally, these overdrafts are very short in duration. They can result in timing issues, mistakes, or agency practice. This section gives the Treasurer the authority to transfer the overdraft amount from other monies deposited in the State Treasury by the state agency, allowing Treasury to clean up overdrafts that are not resolved in a timely manner. This also gives the Treasurer the exclusive authority to charge interest and fees for overdrafts. We currently charge for overdrafts under the authority of the interfund borrowing statutes. However, since we're addressing overdrafts for purposes of allowing the Treasurer to make transfers, we felt it appropriate to craft a single statute that comprehensively deals with overdrafts. Sections 11 and 12 remove the trust funds discussed earlier from the general fund. Section 13 cleans up language referring to statutes amended by this bill in the enabling language of an agriculture statute, or excuse me, an agriculture account. Section 14 repeals ORS 293405, which, as discussed earlier, is replaced with language found in Section 8 of the bill. And at the suggestion of the Department of Justice, it also repeals ORS 293120, which, created in 1915 when a number of accounts were moved into the general fund, is contradictory and appears to no longer perform a useful function. Furthermore, the section appears to give some broad but confusing continuous appropriation authority that, while it doesn't appear to be used, is worrisome. For this reason, the Legislative Fiscal Office supports the repeal of this section. I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Berger.
Well, since we're talking doomsday, the one thing that I'm not... The one thing that stands out that I'm not really clear on is the finger on the button thing, why it is at all advantageous to take away either the governor, the treasurer, or the secretary of state. These are scenarios that are unimaginable.
Were
unimaginable. And I guess I'd like to just further clarify the scenario why you wouldn't want all three of those people at the table if any of these were to come to pass.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we would want all three of them at the table. I think both practically and politically it will be in the interest to have all three of them at the table. I think the issue is if they're at the table and one of them disagrees, doesn't see the need, perhaps it's a situation where one of them feels that the Treasury should take the general fund even further in debt, and the treasurer absolutely disagrees, and the other constitutional officer disagrees, and we are as far down as we're going to go. And under this, the fiduciary responsibility of the treasurer, he is not willing to take the general fund any further into the hole. But we have one of the constitutional officers that has a philosophical disagreement, doesn't believe we should return payments to the public. But we're not there now. The treasurer is going to return the items. So what we want to be able to do is try to create some order to that process instead of the chaos that would occur from just returning them NSF. So it's I think timing is a lot of what the issue is. It's time to act. But again, we as you said, we were in a doomsday mentality when we look at this. And so, well, what are the things in the current process that can go wrong? Well, we identified a number of items, weaknesses in the statute, and one of the questions that came up, well, what happens if one of the officers doesn't agree to register warrants? And as we looked at the statutes, we determined, well, the warrants still have to be returned. they're just going to be returned in an ugly, ugly manner, and we're not going to pay the public interest. And one of the big advantages of paying interest on the items and having a registration process like this is that it allows for the development of a secondary market. There'll be people out there that want that 5% interest, and they'll buy those instruments up. And they'll buy them if, and as we saw in California, which I don't believe paid interest on the warrants at that time. But even if you don't have interest on the items, somebody will buy them. They'll just buy them at a steep discount. And the advantage of doing it in a manner where we're paying interest on the items is that people will be able to get face or close to face value of the instruments depending on the interest environment at the time.
Yeah, I still don't understand why we use warrants versus checks, or why we use a combination of both. In times, at least in the past, whenever times were okay, or that there wasn't cause for alarm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, warrants are a standard payment method for paying budgetary items. There are a number of payments that are made by statute by warrant, and we don't decide when we're going to pay by check or when we're going to pay by warrant and move back and forth between the two. These payments are always made by warrant. These types of budgetary items, expenditures, reimbursements to program accounts, things like that, come out of accounts that are paid by warrant. And that's a much bigger issue than what I'm addressing here on whether or not we want. In when we're in a situation like this, while it's an ugly doomsday scenario, the state is clearly advantaged by having an instrument like a warrant to be able to continue to pay obligations even though it's a deferred payment. And if we simply had checks and had to quit undertaking the obligation.
But your question really is as the background, how the practice of warrant, issuing warrants has been a part of state or public finance.
Mr. Chair, I think if you went back at one time, probably all of the payments were issued by warrant. And then we've slowly added on the ability to make payments via these other mechanisms. Typically, if you look back historically, that's governments paid via warrant.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chair,
it's
not so much a question as a comment.
Yep.
The issue with respect to the constitutional officers, I mean, it does seem to me that in a situation like this, where at the time that this decision would be made, it would obviously be a very politically charged mm-hmm. environment. The idea of requiring 100%, a complete majority, seems to me to, I mean, we would never structure in our own affairs, a situation where it required 100% of the legislature, all 90 members, to vote in favor of something in order to make it happen. I think giving sort of a majority situation here, where two of the three have to come to that determination and will be judged accordingly based on the determination that they make, seems to me to be a pretty reasonable, and I'd be real surprised if you were in a situation where you didn't get all three of them coming to some consensus. But I think you got to at least allow for the possibility that the return of these things unregistered and unpaid would create such a crisis that you've got to allow for the possibility of someone acting not necessarily rationally in that critical moment, and somebody else needing to
reason.
Yeah, right. So I guess I'd just say that I'm actually more comfortable with this change, because I think it ensures that one person can't necessarily tie the process up in such a way that could have extremely detrimental effects on the state in a situation where we're already going to be underwater in a substantial way.
Especially where the consequences, I guess, of not proceeding to registration is simply the dishonoring of the warrants. It would be one thing, I guess, if absent consent, the warrants would just continue to be honored. But here, absent consent, the warrants are going to be dishonored. I think I agree there's probably more protection for the warrant holders, which are likely going to be citizens, taxpayers, vendors, and others doing business with the state. I think there's probably more protection for them in that lower threshold. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
Just to make sure I'm perfectly clear about Section 8.
Okay.
Well, we have metaphors just all over the place here this morning, don't we?
Under existing law, the treasurer is responsible for all, responsible to make sure that every expenditure is a legal expenditure. And with this bill, it shifts it to the signer of the officer who signs the expenditure request.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, yes, it adds that burden to the signer. It adds this certification idea,
which is entirely reasonable. Are we pretty confident that the people in the field who are signing are trained well enough to know what is and what isn't legal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, yes, I believe so.
Thank you.
Just a drafting thing I see on page 4, line 45, the state treasurer must make the payment from that fund only. That's not usually, didn't used to see must in statute, did we? There's always shall. Shows where we've come in our grammar.
Mr. Chair, in some of these bills, you notice that shall is being changed.
Yes.
I think it's stylistic issues by legislative counsel that has a pen. So.
All right. Other questions? Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2135? Are there any amendments?
No.
Okay. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2135. Colleagues, thankfully, none of us in this committee will be asked to carry this on the floor. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It does.
Oh, you're going to tell me it's coming off?
Well, the parties, I think, would just assume it did, and Ways and Means, their fiscal office, has no objection to removing it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, sure. Representative Pass.
I think you should carry the football.
Yeah.
The football. Good.
But Mr. Chair, to assist you, I would move that we rescind the Ways and Means.
Wait a second here. Did I open a work session yet? I don't think I did. You're out of order. actually, Paul, if you could maybe call the Speaker's office just to confirm, and if that's the case, we'll come back to this. If we can rescind that subsequent referral, rats. Okay, we'll close the public hearing, if I haven't already, on House Bill 2135, and we will not go to work session now until we get clarification on our subsequent referral. So let's go to a public hearing on House Bill 2136. Dr. Strangelove, welcome back.
For the record, I'm Peter Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury, and I promise this one is a lot easier. House Bill 2136 clarifies conflicting language relative to maturity date restrictions on local government investments. 293.135 sub 1 gives general authority for local government investment officer to invest out to 18 months or the date of anticipated use of the funds, whichever shorter. Paragraph A of that subsection allows for longer maturities if the government unit has adopted an investment policy that's been reviewed by the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board. Paragraph B deals with matching investment maturities to anticipated cash flow needs, but for some reason refers to periods exceeding 1 year rather than 18 months. As the authority to invest out to 18 months already exists, there's no practical or functional purpose for this shorter maturity. And the only effect of this paragraph is to allow for matching maturities to anticipated uses beyond 18 months. These changes clarify that as the purpose of the paragraph. Subsection 3 provides no additional authority or restriction from that found earlier in the statute and is therefore removed.
Okay. Any questions? This one seems a little more straightforward. No questions? Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2136? All right, then I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2136.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Berger.
House Bill 2136 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll. Oh, I'm sorry, Dick, do you have anything to add on this one?
Right.
Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye. Berger?
Berger?
Aye.
Farr?
Aye.
Half?
Aye.
Hobson?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2136 goes to the floor with a due pass. They need a carrier on that one. Okay. Do you want that one? All right. Thank you very much. Representative Virgil will be the carrier. And with that, let's stand in recess. Please hang on. Let's wait until we get word on the subsequent referral on 2135. Then we'll reconvene and move that one appropriately. So we'll be in recess. We will reconvene the House Revenue Committee and enter a work session on House Bill 2135. For the record, Mr. Warner has confirmed with the Speaker's office that we may remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means and pass this bill directly to the floor. It has been determined to have no fiscal impact. So with that, then, we're in work session. Representative Williams, I think you had a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means and refer the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves the rescission of the Ways and Means subsequent referral on House Bill 2135 and that the bill be passed to the floor directly with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2135 goes to the floor with a due pass, and I'll carry the football. We're adjourned.